Hello, I'm Eamon Ryan and you're listening to Open Field, a new podcast bringing to focus a range of issues close to my own heart. I'm speaking to a range of individuals, from environmental campaigners, scientists, technologists, right through to musicians, athletes and artists that I meet in my everyday work. It is an open field, and I would love to receive your thoughts about this podcast. You can email me at eamon.ryan@oireachtas.ie and find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. I'm joined here today by Christine Milne, the former head of the Green Party in Australia, from Tasmania. Grew up on a dairy farm in Tasmania, and she's here visiting Ireland and speaking at the Green Party conference. Thought it'd be a great opportunity to get to have a conversation with her for our podcast, to share stories and share some lessons and share some thoughts on where the Green Party, on where we're coming from, where we might go. And I suppose I should say before I start asking anything, Christine, the Tasmanian Greens were the first Green Party ever, as I recall. They were the mother of Green Parties. How did that happen? Why did it start in Tasmania? And how did you get involved?
Well, thanks, Eamon. It's great to be here in Ireland. I am a fifth generation Tasmanian, but I have to say my forebears came on the convict ships from England, and I'm not sure about whether they were convicts from Ireland, but certainly a lot of them came from Ireland. I was brought up on a dairy farm in northwest Tasmania, and at the time that I went to university, which is the early 1970s, the Hydroelectric Commission, which was all powerful in Tasmania at that time, wanted to flood a most beautiful lake, Lake Pedder. It's a unique lake in that it had a pink quartz beach, an internal highland lake with a huge, this quartz beach that you could land a light aircraft on. So a beautiful beach. And they wanted to flood it to increase hydroelectric capacity in Tasmania. And a group of people got together and formed a political party called the United Tasmania Group. And it was developed on a philosophy by Dr. Richard Jones, and it had four principles. But fundamental was that the environment has to be central to everything. Mm. Up until then, all political parties had assumed that the earth was free, and the fight was only over who benefited from harvesting whatever they could from the earth. So the Labor parties tended to say, well, the workers who contribute to this, they should be the ones who get the benefits. And the capitalists, if you like, said, well, actually, we own the factories, we own the plants, so we should maximise our profits. And so the fight up until then had been how the wealth was distributed. Mm. Everybody just assumed the earth was free. And up came the United Tasmania Group saying, no, actually, we have to value nature. Mm. We cannot just assume that it is infinite, that it can give forever and absorb all waste forever without serious consequences. So that is where the ecology as a fundamental principle of politics began. The other principles, if I can just add to those quickly, were social justice, participatory democracy, and peace and non-violence. And they remain the four elements of Green parties worldwide. And that's where it started in Tasmania in the early 1970s.
I was just going to ask her what those other three were. So that's very useful. So you were there. Were you involved in that campaign, or were you studying at the time, or where were you at the time?
Well, it's interesting because I was from a fairly poor background, and it was my mother, who had been the product of a Catholic boarding school, Presentation Nuns, who was determined that her two daughters would be educated, and that was really something for rural Tasmania in the 70s. And so she worked very hard, and I did too, to try to get scholarships and bursaries and things to get to university. So when I got there, and this big campaign was on to save the lake, and people were involved in that, I was an observer of it, and I supported it, and I thought, well, obviously the arguments don't stack up for this hydroelectric scheme, so it won't happen, and I'm here to work because everybody else has made so many sacrifices to get me to university. And so I was an observer of the Lake Pedder campaign, not a driver of it. However, when the parliamentarians in Tasmania took absolutely no notice of the evidence and went ahead and flooded the lake, that was my political empowerment. I recognised that from now on, evidence wasn't going to be all that it would take to get good decisions out of parliamentarians. And that's why I've always said that the loss of Lake Pedder saved the Franklin. And I made my commitment then that if they ever tried to do this again, I would be there. And so a few years later, in the early 1980s, the Hydroelectric Commission decided that they would dam the Franklin River. And so Dr. Bob Brown was leading a campaign to stop the damming of the river. And so off I went to the blockade. And I was arrested on the blockade and taken to Risdon Women's Prison. And on the way I was going to prison, I thought to myself, you know, those presentation nuns.
They won't be happy.
I thought they insisted that one had to stand up for one's convictions and have the, you know, really have the courage of your convictions. And I thought to myself, I don't quite think this is actually what they meant at the time, but it was very important to me.
They've moved on now. The presentation nuns I meet now are the most radical ecologists that you'd ever meet.
Indeed they are.
They've found some spirituality in cosmology and ecology as much as anything else. They're quite radical.
They are now, but at that time I don't quite think that's what they had in mind. But anyway, after the Franklin, I went back teaching on the northwest coast of Tasmania and probably would have continued in a career in education, always supporting environmentalism, had North Broken Hill and Noranda of Canada not decided to build a $1 billion pulp mill in the very district that I was brought up.
Are they paper companies, were there?
They were big pulp and paper companies, and they were going to cut down native forests in Tasmania. They were going to use an elemental bleaching sequence and pump all that pollution out into Bass Strait and spew all that pollution over these beautiful farmlands. And so I led the campaign with farmers from the district and all over the state against the pulp mill, and we won. And on the back of that, the Premier of the day called an election to try to get the pulp mill back on track. And so I stood with Dr. Bob Brown and three other people on a united ticket to protect the environment in Tasmania, and we were all elected and went straight into balance of power, supporting a Labor government. And that was 1989, and it was a few years before we then formed the Tasmanian Greens and the Australian Greens. That was in the early 90s.
So actually, I said that the first mother of Green parties, it was a campaigning party originally in the 70s based on those values. And then, as you said, it was only, it really became identifiably maybe green, although it was, as I say, those four principles are resonant today. We recognise immediately anyone involved in green politics, nodding head, that's where we come from, that's what we are.
Exactly. But, well, how it came to be green. So the United Tasmania Group, we argue, is the world's first green party. The Values Party in New Zealand was formed slightly afterwards. It became, those principles became known as the Green Party because Petra Kelly came to Tasmania and saw what we were doing, and she saw the philosophy of the United Tasmania Group and she really liked it. And then she went back through Sydney at the time that the union movement were holding the green bans to prevent the knocking down of heritage buildings right in the heart of Sydney. And the green bans were actually the unionists getting together to prevent the knocking down of those buildings. And Petra Kelly loved the idea of the union movement working with the conservation movement to protect the heritage of Sydney. And so she took the name from the Green Bands with the philosophy of the United Tasmania Group, the four principles, came back to Europe, formed a party and contested the European election as a Green Party from Germany.
It's funny you mentioned there the kind of the connections, because I met Petra Kelly in the 80s when she came here. She was connected to the Irish Greens, but also our leader, the person who set up our party, Christopher Fettes, it was 1981, put an ad in the paper and said, calling people to come to a hotel to meet if they wanted to help set up a party. And if you ask Christopher about it, he comes back and says, actually, he was inspired by the Values Party in New Zealand, the one you just mentioned. So it's funny how in a connected world, that's just some of those ideas ricochet around and they find a base. Can I go back then? So you find yourself in elected office, and as you said, holding the balance of power. How long did that last? What was your experience after that, in the next election? Were you all able to hold on to your seats, or what happened?
Well, it's interesting. We were in balance of power supporting a Labor government, and we achieved some fantastic things. We doubled the size of the Tasmanian Wilderness World Heritage Area, for example. But when we came to the next election, we lost a lot of our primary vote. And that was because the majority government of the Liberal Party, which had led up to 1989, had effectively broken the state. But because it was a majority government, nobody actually really knew the state of the books. Once you're in a minority government, though, then it opens up transparency to all the figures. And so we suddenly were in this situation of trying to manage a financial mess that a majority government had created. However, the community don't really understand that. And so from their point of view, why were there all these cuts to public services and so on being made? And so at the next election, we had achieved 17% of the vote in 1989. That went down to 12.5% of the vote 2.5 years later. And sadly, that has been the experience of the Greens. In Tasmania, we were in balance of power between 1996 to 98. Federally, we were also, when I was the leader, we were in balance of power between 2010 and 2013. In every case, we have achieved some remarkable things. That middle period in the 90s, we achieved gay law reform in Tasmania. We decriminalised it, which it was appalling. You could go to jail for 21 years for being homosexual in Tasmania then. Mm. We achieved gun law reform on the back of the Port Arthur massacre, which took tremendous courage from everybody but made such a huge difference. We apologised to the stolen generation of Aboriginal people. It was a very progressive time in Tasmanian politics. And then in the period we had federally, I knew exactly what I wanted to do, and that was achieve a whole clean energy package for Australia. And so we not only achieved a carbon price, which brought down emissions, but we secured $10 billion to go into the expansion of renewable energy. We set up the Australian Renewable Energy Agency, a carbon farming initiative, a climate change authority, a whole lot of institutional changes, made a huge difference to rolling out renewable energy in Australia. And yet at the next election, we again lost the primary vote. So it's the pattern seems to have been that when we don't have the power and we're in opposition effectively, we build our political capital, we get into a position of balance of power, we actually achieve a great deal of both institutional and policy change, but we never get the credit for it because the government of the day takes the credit for the good things, and we get blamed for any instability or any failures of a government in which we're actually not taking part except through the agreements that we've made to put them into government in the first place. And this is something that worldwide Greens grapple with.
Yeah, no, every single Green party that's gone into government in Europe has lost all its seats in the election afterwards. But we're a persistent bunch.
We are.
And mostly you come back, and actually the experience strengthens you and gives you experience, which helps, I hope, the next time around. That period you mentioned about, you were, as you say, in a very influential position. At that stage, you were co-leader of the Australian Green Party. You were a senator in the Australian Senate. You were, was it 2010 to 2013, was it? Kind of effectively, while you weren't members of government, you were supporting the government and had a
a written agreement.
A written agreement with the Labour Party, I think, again, wasn't it, in that instance. What was the experience of that? What would you recommend someone else to go into government? Or would you like to have gone further to actually take a ministerial office rather than having a written agreement and kind of support it from the Parliament, as it was?
Well, there are a number of lessons. The first one, and I say this to every Green Party considering supporting another party in government, and that is to understand that if you have a written agreement, you will never get more than what is on the paper when the ink dries. That's it. After that, you are fighting to have those things honoured and implemented, if at all. And our experience has been that you get the majority of it, and then the final things that the government doesn't really want to do but agreed to do, they just don't do, because in the end they look you in the eye and more or less challenge you, either bring us down, but you really have no other way of censoring us in regard to that. In terms of ministries, I'm a believer in the Greens taking ministries. If we are going to be holding up a government, if you like, or supporting a government, and we're going to be judged at the next election on what that government achieves, then you might as well be in there as a minister. Having said that, I think it's essential that the Greens choose which ministry that they will take and get a guarantee on the budget allocation to that ministry, because the experience in some places has been they will give you some appalling ministry and then cut the budget for it, and then you'll be a failure as a minister and it makes it an even worse scenario. So there are some clear things that you have to get straight. The other issue is, do you go to inner cabinet or outer cabinet? In New Zealand, James Shaw has chosen to have the climate ministry but outer cabinet, so that he is not held responsible for cabinet decisions. But I'm not sure that a lot of the electorate will actually understand the difference at the next election, so I'll be interested to see how that goes. But I actually think that we need the experience as Greens as much as we possibly can of getting us ready for government, because ultimately that's why we're in politics, to govern along the principles that are Green principles and actually change the world, because that is essentially the task. And we're overwhelmed by global warming and inequality, and the Greens are actually focused on addressing both.
In the end, what was the issue that divided you with the Labour Party? Was the one thing that kind of you actually couldn't get them over the line that was in the written agreement that was the real difficult one? What was the point of difference, or the one that maybe you remember now? I'm sure there were loads, but what was the one that sticks in your mind?
In terms of what they didn't deliver?
Yeah.
Yes. So the way we have structured the agreements to support governments is to look at the issues on which we agree and just say that they are a set of issues on which we all agree that we're going to do those things. Then there are these other issues which Labor will agree to deliver. In the case of the Gillard government, Labor government, one of the key areas that we wanted addressed was political donations. Mm. This has been a really major issue in Australia, because I argue we are no longer a democracy, we're actually a plutocracy. The amount of money flowing into Australian politics through donations, and then the revolving door of ministers who leave the parliament and go straight into corporate roles in the area in which they've been ministers, is just disgraceful, and that buys access, and around the revolving door goes. Mm. So political donations was a big one, and the Prime Minister, we'd reached a point where it was very clear to me that Prime Minister Gillard was finished, that she was not going to deliver any more of the policy areas in the agreement, and we could either just sit there and basically hold up a government which was not delivering, not consulting really, and was making its way to the next election, or we could say, right, that's it, and just say to the community, we will still give this government confidence and supply because we believe in stability and we said we would, but you have to understand that that's as far as it goes.
One of the things I was proud of in our time in government, now it was a subsequent government in fairness to them, but they introduced legislation that we'd written, which was an end to corporate donations in Irish politics.
Fantastic. Effectively.
So bring that back to Australia with you and tell
them,
even the Irish convicts are doing it, or not doing it.
Well, I think that is fantastic because it is poisoned democracy in Australia.
And America and Britain.
It's just, unless we can change it, it makes it more and more difficult. The Tasmanian election, which has just been held before I came to Europe, the gambling companies who have a monopoly on poker machines in pubs and clubs in Tasmania poured hundreds of thousands of dollars into the election to support one of the parties who will maintain poker machines in pubs and clubs.
Classic.
And it was just a classic case of buying the election.
One of the instincts of a green philosophy, political philosophy, is maybe not so much attention on the individual leader or kind of the cult of personality ain't exactly our thing. I remember there was a rule in our party for years that you couldn't even put your face in a poster. And then it was slightly varied. You said you could put it in if you put the planet Earth there as well. And because there were black and white posters, people at the time thought it was actually the moon, not Earth. But we eventually got over that. But what's your experience been? How do you find, like at that time when you would have been in really the centre of the eye of political attention and media, and is it difficult? Or like, we find it very difficult sometimes to get women involved in politics. I think partly because they're too intelligent to think, why would you put yourself into that position? How have you found it? What's your personal experience?
Well, I certainly don't like celebrity politics, and I really think that that has been a downfall where the fortunes of parties have tended to be on the popularity of the leader, the presidential style, if you like, the US presidential style sort of come to Australia and the UK as well, whereas my preference is for cabinet leadership. Mm-hmm. So my view was always, I am the leader and my job is to bring out the best in my team and we do this together. Mm-hmm. So it was always about making sure that everybody could do the best job that they could possibly do. And that meant that I wanted to share the media opportunities, that I wanted to actually involve everybody. But of course, that didn't suit a media that just wanted the leaders out there leading the debate. And so that was not regarded as a strength. And this is one of the things now where I think this issue of feminist leadership, as I would say, and I don't just put that as being women's leadership, I mean feminist leadership in the sense of being more empathetic, more compassionate, more inclusive, less personalised. All of that is actually 21st century leadership. Mm. It's what that flexibility, that emotional intelligence, all of those things is now what people want in leaders. Mm. And yet we are still seeing what I think is rather anachronistic, this male leadership style being out there. In terms of how it felt being in the role, well, Australia is a misogynist country. It just is. And that abuse that Julia Gillard had to put up with was appalling as our first female Prime Minister. And it came from the extreme right most of the time and was facilitated by the shock jocks in the media. But to her credit, she was very dignified through all of that. But again, this comes down to women in politics. You know, 50% of women on the planet, 50% representation, equal should be. But having said that, just because you get a woman in politics doesn't mean to say you're going to get progressive politics. Mm. And Julia Gillard made a speech which went viral when she attacked Tony Abbott. And it was called her misogyny speech. She just absolutely attacked him for the way he was behaving. And everyone said, isn't it marvellous that we've got a female Prime Minister who's actually taken on this misogyny? And I said, well, yes, but I find it difficult to be as enthusiastic as everyone else because the very morning that she made that speech, she cut the budget for single parents in Australia. She cut the budget. Now, overwhelming majority of single parents in Australia are female. And so here you had a woman as a prime minister held up as a feminist leader, actually undermining systemically the capacity of single parents to parent their children. Now, you know, that is what you go, and Julia was actually a feminist, I think, in the broader sense. But you get a lot of women in politics who do absolutely nothing to advance the cause of women's equality, of legal protections for women. Look at Margaret Thatcher, who's a classic case, and there are plenty of them around the planet. So what we need is a leadership style which is based on those very ideas of inclusion, compassion, that generosity of spirit and so on, and that is not just female. It doesn't exclude men, and it's not all women.
No, I think we're in a 21st century where ecology will be the key issue, and
absolutely,
and that's about connection and interconnection, and it's not hierarchical, it's systems.
And exactly, it's totally systems-based, but women are going to be incredibly important to that. I was just looking at Paul Hawken's work, Drawdown, his latest on climate, and he was assessing all the different actions you can take across the planet that will make the biggest difference to reducing emissions. And two of the top ones are educating women and women's reproductive rights. That they will actually have the biggest impact systemically across the planet and bringing down emissions. So that's very interesting.
You've done a lot of work on climate. I mean, not just that work in government where you put in the carbon tax and renewables incentives and so on, but in the whole policy side. In Australia, what's the effect of climate? What are you seeing? Is it starting to hit home, or is it how is that affecting how people think?
Well, two separate questions. How is it affecting Australia? Global warming is already having an extreme effect in Australia. All our extreme weather events are even more intense than they have been previously. We've always had floods and fires and, you know, in Australia, cyclones and the rest. But now we're having much more intense heat waves. We're having longer periods of bushfire weather. Effectively, the whole climate has moved at least 100 kilometres south. So areas that used to be quite fertile are no longer fertile. Southwest Western Australia used to get a reasonable rainfall. It doesn't anymore because the low pressure system that would drop rain onto that area is now not going as far north. So we're seeing absolute changes in the landscape, in rainfall patterns. Around Tasmania, for example, we used to have the most magnificent kelp forests, marine kelp forests. Now the waters around Tasmania have warmed so much that the East Australia current, warm current, is coming further down the coast. The cold sub-Antarctic uprising is coming further, is not coming as far north. As a result, the invasive sea urchin is coming down on that East Australia current. We have lost the kelp forest. We now just have barrens where they used to be. And so it's just a tragedy to see that happening. And you're seeing just changes in the... what that also means is that your seabirds have to... You're in a warm current that's nutrient poor. So whereas we used to have a good fishery and used to have a lot of seabirds and so on, now not so, because you've got that nutrient poor environment. Tasmania, of course, is last stop to Antarctica. So the Southern Ocean and the Antarctic is of incredible importance. And it's the place on the planet where all of the oceans on the planet mix in the Antarctic. And so there's a huge amount of science now coming out of that work on the Southern Ocean. And you're seeing changes with acidity, for example, acidification, so that the microscopic creatures can no longer form their shells. So you're seeing you're at the base of the food chain, you are going to have some real issues. And, you know, I always say to people, we're out there trying to save the whales, but if we don't actually save plankton, you're going to see the marine environment collapse. So we're just seeing incredible. You asked the second question about what do people think. Well, you would expect, given what they're seeing, given that you know, there are weeks, a week in Australia where the temperature will be over 40 degrees and at night not much less, and you're seeing more people dying from heat exhaustion than you actually, you know, had in bushfire losses and so on. And yet the climate denial industry in Australia is intense. We are a resource-based economy. And so there's been a massive amount of money spent in Australia by the coal industry, by the gas industry, to prop up fossil fuels and keep legitimising fossil fuels. And so people don't vote on the climate. Now, you can't understand when they're actually the frog in the water why they aren't voting on the climate, but they're not. And that is why I say, in part, why we are a plutocracy, not a democracy. People are just not informed about the extent to which they're being manipulated by the Murdoch press, very big in Australia, and very much a perpetrator of climate denial.
Can I finish with asking a broader question? Well, bring it back home, first of all, I'd love to know what's happened to that dairy farm. And I'd also love to know, because for us in Ireland, in terms of our message, ain't that different to what a difficulty in Australia about winning people over to the sense that addressing this climate issue is going to be good for us. And I'm always looking for Irish cousins around the world that we can, because, you know, it's different to, if we point to the goody two-shoes Scandinavians are doing something, it's kind of, well, they're just superior or something. But actually, if we can show that our former convict cousins who went out to Tasmania are doing something, it maybe gives us an inspiration. Particularly on the issue of land and the use of, and food and agriculture. And if you're coming from a daughter of a dairy farmer, what happens? What's happened to that farm, and what's happening in Tasmania in terms of how you treat your land, or how you get food from your land, or how does that work? How is it working?
Well, the food system globally is in trouble, and Tasmania has been impacted the same as everywhere else by heavy promotion of chemicals and agribusiness over a long period of time. So the small family dairy farms of the like that I was brought up on were rapidly bought up and turned into bigger farms. But nevertheless, some of them still remain. But the issue has become that the children of dairy farmers don't want to go back on the land. And so this is the issue. And so they reach a certain age where they want to sell the farm because effectively it's their superannuation, it's their income in old age, and what do they do? And so we've seen quite a lot of foreign investment in Tasmania. That's caused a lot of resentment. But people are saying, well, what can I, how can I hold on to the farm, but I'm not capable of working it as I used to? And so that's why I'd say to them, well, renewable energy is your friend, because you can actually sit on the veranda and watch the money roll in without actually having to do anything, because you can have a solar plant or you can have a wind farm, and you can mix that with agriculture. The other thing is to be thinking of high value, low volume product. It's no use trying to compete in the undifferentiated commodity markets. You'll always be a price taker. That is never going to get you anywhere. So in Tasmania, we transformed from that undifferentiated agricultural base of just growing potatoes for the cannery or peas for the cannery, and now we do the high end. So Tasmania tries to produce very high quality seafood, fruit and vegetables at the very top end, so that we can freight it overseas and get the highest prices in those markets. So Tasmanian cherries into Japan and China, for example, Tasmanian lobsters into those markets actually generate quite high prices. But interesting, global warming is affecting aquaculture. We did develop aquaculture around Tasmania's coasts, but with warming waters, it means that if you're going to try and do that, then you end up with having to use antibiotics and so on. And so now the big question for aquaculture worldwide is, how are we going to maintain the production given that the waters are warming? And my view has been, look, you're just going to have to bring it onshore. You're going to have to, you're going to have to learn to use renewable energy and farm these fish on shore if you're going to go in for aquaculture. So there is a crisis in small farms in Tasmania, as I suspect there might well be in Ireland. And it's that issue of once the next generation has had the benefit of an education, they have the world at their feet, and many of them don't want to come home. And I don't think any of us have perfected a policy setting that encourages other young people to somehow have a pathway back onto the land. But food security is a huge issue globally, and it's something I spoke about a lot in the Senate. We are going to see the land grabbing by countries that can't feed their own people, and we absolutely must resist that. And I'm a big supporter of not selling agricultural land and water offshore.
Okay, well, Christina, you're an inspiration to us here. Your work in the Global Greens as well as in Australian Senate. And fair play to you, just sticking with that studies way back in the day. So you got to uni, so you got to the protest, so you became elected, so you ended up in Canberra, so you affected the world, you know, a variety of different ways.
Thanks, Amy.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Open Field. Please let me know what you think by emailing me at eamon.ryan@arachthis.ie, or you can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram and LinkedIn. This podcast was produced by Benedict Schlepper Connolly and Anna Conlon. The theme music is by Benedict Schlepper Connolly. You can always find the latest edition of Open Field on my website, eamonryan.ie, or on all main podcasting platforms. Bye for now.